From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week, the president was found in contempt of court on the Paula Jones lawsuit, and Kenneth Starr is saying that the law authorizing the position of independent counsel should not be renewed. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about covering the presidential sex scandal with Newsweek reporter Michael Isikoff, who's written a new book called Uncovering Clinton. Also, we discuss the bond between Russia and Serbia with New York Times former Moscow bureau chief Serge Schmaiman. He's now acting foreign editor. His book, Echoes of a Native Land, tells the history of the Russian village his family is from. His family was forced out by the Russian Revolution. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Serta, maker of the Serta Perfect Sleeper mattress, helping generations of Americans to sleep since 1931.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war in Yugoslavia eclipsed what had been the national obsession, the presidential sex scandal. But this week, it was back in the news. A federal judge held President Clinton in contempt of court, saying he had willfully provided false testimony under oath about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky in the Paula Jones sexual misconduct lawsuit. And today, independent counsel Kenneth Starr urged a Senate panel not to renew the independent counsel law that authorizes the position. Journalist Michael Isikoff has covered the presidential sex scandal since Paula Jones' 1994 press conference in which she alleged that the president sexually harassed her. Isikoff was the first reporter onto the Monica Lewinsky story. Now he's written a book about investigating the scandal called Uncovering Clinton. Isikoff was a reporter for The Washington Post from 1981 till 94 when he joined Newsweek. He first heard about Monica Lewinsky through Linda Tripp. He told me how Tripp became his source.
In January of 1997, at the time that the Supreme Court was hearing arguments about whether the Paula Jones case should go forward, I received some information from one of the Jones lawyers, Joe Camerata, about an anonymous phone call he had gotten at just about that time involving another woman. He didn't know who the woman was, but there were a number of clues as to the identity of the other woman. The other woman claimed that something like what happened to Paula Jones had happened to her while she was in the White House, while she was working at the White House. I eventually, taking the clues and the tips from the anonymous phone call, figured out that this woman was most likely Kathleen Willey. I asked her for the names of any people who she had related this incident to at the time, and one of the women she mentioned was Linda Tripp.
The first time she offered to play you tape of her phone conversations with Monica Lewinsky, you declined to hear the tape. Why did you decline?
It was a very uncomfortable situation. I had been talking on and off to Tripp for months, first about the Willey incident, but she had made clear to me that the Willey incident was not the real story here. She thought there was a more serious story that was ongoing involving a young woman whose identity she was at that point not willing to divulge, but who was a former White House intern who was then working for another agency of the United States government and had been involved in an ongoing sexual relationship with the president. I certainly wanted to know a bit more, especially when she said that the relationship involved efforts by the president to placate her by finding her employment either within the federal government at other federal agencies or, as it later turned out, outside the government. I got invited in October of 1997 to attend a meeting at the apartment of Jonah Goldberg, the son of a New York literary agent, Lucianne Goldberg, who Tripp said was advising her about what to do about all this. And I attended the meeting and for the first time learned that Tripp had been secretly taping her conversations with Lewinsky. And that's when I first learned the name, Monica Lewinsky. I didn't know it until I went to the meeting. And I didn't know that there was any taping involved. Taping without somebody else's consent is not something that I, as a reporter, do. And given that Tripp informed me that she was, that her secret taping of this woman, Monica Lewinsky, was ongoing at that time, I did not want to become involved or enmeshed in that process. I was more than willing and quite eager to hear what Linda Tripp had to tell me about what Lewinsky had told her, but I did not want to participate even by extension in the taping of Monica Lewinsky and declined to listen to the tapes.
When did you change your mind about listening?
When I learned much later that Ken Starr, the independent counsel, had launched a secret criminal investigation of the president, and the tapes were the central evidence in this investigation. At that point, the taping by Tripp was completed or was done. It was not an ongoing process, and that was the part that bothered me the most. But more importantly, at that point, I thought it was very important to hear what was on the tapes and what was the evidence in this investigation of the president.
At one point in your discussions with Linda Tripp, she suggested that she try to steal the semen-stained dress and get it to you. Would you describe her plan?
Well, it was pretty unusual, to say the least. As I say, during this period of the fall of 1997, I was in touch with Tripp and, to a lesser extent, Lucianne Goldberg, sort of hearing what they had to say, but mainly working on other stories. And then one, as I describe in the book, one morning I receive a somewhat breathless call from a whispering Linda Tripp telling me that... she had been to Lewinsky's apartment the night before, and she had been shown this dress that Lewinsky had told her had the president's semen on it. And, she said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I think that's rather incredible. What else could one say under those circumstances?" And she said, "What do you think?" And I said, "About what?" I said, "What do you think I should take it?" And at that point, I was a bit startled and said, "And do what with it?" And she said, "Give it to you." And I paused and said, "And what would I do with it?" And she said, "Well, you could have it tested." And at this point, I sort of, took a deep breath and said, what is going on here?" I tried to impress upon her that... there really wasn't anything I could do with the dress, even if I were inclined to take it, which I would not have been because I was not about to become a party to theft. There would be no practical way for me to test it anyway. I didn't have a sample of the president's DNA. There wasn't anything I could do with that dress to prove the relationship between Lewinsky and the president. And I mostly just chalked it up as something rather a bizarre development and thought that Tripp was a bit strange, to say the least, in asking me about this, and sort of put it aside. And of course, months later, the dress returned in a rather significant way.
What were your thoughts about Linda Tripp as a source? On the one hand, she was giving you great information. On the other hand, she was secretly taping phone conversations with somebody who was ostensibly a friend. She was offering to steal that friend's dress and give it to you so that you could get it tested in a laboratory.
I thought that I was profoundly ambivalent about all this. You're right. I was... a reporter, and I was interested in her information because it seemed to me that it was potentially quite newsworthy. On the other hand, I did have a lot of doubts about what she was doing and about the role that I was playing, even in listening to what she had to say. But it was clear to me, or it became increasingly clear, that she saw me as the vehicle to get the story out. Now, there was a coincidence of interests here, because if what she was telling me was true, and if all of what she was telling me was true, I thought it said quite a bit about Bill Clinton. I thought it was particularly in the context of the ongoing Paula Jones lawsuit, it was rather shocking behavior by the president. It was rather reckless behavior by the president, and it had the potential to create great disruption to his presidency. On the other hand, I was very wary of Tripp and of becoming too enmeshed in what increasingly became clear. And I didn't know everything at the time. I only learned these things, over time. But her machinations involved to essentially entrap the president were gave me a great deal of pause as well.
At what point did you think it's time to actually print something about Monica Lewinsky?
Not until I learned in a rather on a rather dramatic afternoon that Tripp had gone to Star, that Star had launched this secret criminal investigation of the president, that he had wired Tripp for a lunch with Lewinsky at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And at that point, there was no question in my mind that for an independent counsel to go to this extraordinary length of launching a secret criminal investigation of the president and wiring a woman in an effort to sting the president's alleged girlfriend, that that was a quite monumental story. That would tell us as much about Ken Starr as it would about Bill Clinton. In fact, my initial reaction when I heard about Starr getting involved in this was, that's nuts, and that this was going to blow up in somebody's face, and whether it was going to be Bill Clinton or Ken Starr at that point, I didn't know. I thought it was as equally possible that it was going to blow up in Starr's face and discredit Starr as it would Clinton. I think at the end, it probably brought much discredit to both men, but at least that's how I initially perceived it.
My guest is Newsweek reporter Michael Isikoff. His new book is called Uncovering Clinton. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Isikoff. He's written a new book about covering the presidential sex scandal called Uncovering Clinton. Would you describe the debate at Newsweek about whether to publish the Monica Lewinsky story when you thought it was time to go with it?
Yes, and it was quite dramatic because it took place on the same Saturday that Clinton was being deposed in the Paula Jones lawsuit and being asked questions about Monica Lewinsky, having no idea at that point that the allegations of his relationship with Lewinsky were known not just to Newsweek magazine, but to the independent counsel, Ken Starr, and that he was at that moment the subject of a criminal investigation into obstruction and subordination of perjury. At that point, we knew all this at Newsweek. We also knew that Starr had gone to the Justice Department and that Janet Reno had authorized an expanded mandate for Starr to conduct this investigation. Stripped of the sexual dimension, this would have been a no-brainer. It was at that point a matter of official record that Starr had received a expanded mandate to conduct this new criminal investigation of the president and had gone to this, as I said, extraordinary length of conducting a sting of Lewinsky designed to gather evidence about the president. But it was, at its core, about a sexual relationship, and that made everybody uneasy, especially because it involved a woman, Monica Lewinsky, who at that point we didn't really know anything about. We had not had a chance to interview her. We had not had a chance to see her, to listen to her voice. Well, we had listened to her voice because we listened to the tapes the night before, but we were going to be taking a private figure, Monica Lewinsky, and thrusting her into the middle of a media maelstrom that would instantly erupt once this story became public. So there was a lot of agonizing about what to do about this. Now, a number of us felt that the fact of the criminal investigation was made this story a compelling newsworthy event that we had an obligation to tell our readers about. But there was this nagging fear among the editors that Lewinsky could well have made all this up, that she really didn't have anything like the relationship with the president that she had described to Linda Tripp, that Starr may discover that very quickly, and that we would go with a very big news story that about this criminal investigation hinged on the allegations of a sexual relationship, and it would quickly become clear that no such relationship existed. Now, in retrospect, that is obviously not what took place, but the editor's fear of going with a story that was going to blow up in Newsweek's face ultimately carried the day, and Newsweek did not publish the story that weekend.
Do you think that was the right decision?
No.
Why?
Because I think that, as I said, I argued very strongly, my colleague Danny Kleinman, and ultimately assistant managing editor Evan Thomas, all argued that the fact of the Starr investigation was such an overwhelming news event that we had an obligation to report it.
What questions do you still have, if any, about the relationship of Kenneth Starr and his office with Linda Tripp?
Well, I think that Tripp misled everybody. She certainly misled Monica Lewinsky, for starters, but she misled Starr. The critical moment in this whole investigation, in this whole story, really comes down to Monday evening, January 12th, 1998. And this is a meeting that hasn't gotten much attention, but it's the night Jackie Bennett and several of his deputies go visit Linda Tripp in her home in Columbia, Maryland. And they, for the first time, hear in detail Tripp's allegations about Lewinsky and how Lewinsky had been pressuring her, Tripp, to lie under oath in the Paula Jones lawsuit. And Tripp says that she was so frightened by this and so disturbed by this that she was going to wire herself to gain new tape recordings of what she is describing to Starr's people as a federal crime or federal crimes. And Jackie Bennett stops her and says, you're not going to make any more recordings. If there's going to be recordings, we're going to do them. And that is really the moment that Starr's office becomes committed to conducting this investigation. And what is amazing when you look back in retrospect at that instant is how little Jackie Bennett and Starr's people knew about what they were getting into. Linda Tripp didn't tell Jackie Bennett and his aides that she had essentially arranged through the Paula Jones lawyers for the subpoena that she says, you know, she was so frightened of, that she had in effect set all this up. She didn't tell Jackie Bennett that she had been talking to Lucianne Goldberg, a New York literary agent, who had been in touch with all the lawyers for Paula Jones. She didn't tell Jackie Bennett that she had been talking to me at Newsweek and that I knew about all of these claims. So when Bennett made the decision to have Starr get involved, he was really flying blind. Now, in his defense, he will say, and one can at least understand where he's coming from, he didn't know what Tripp wasn't telling him. On the other hand, I think it is probably legitimate to ask whether or not some more prudence and caution should have been taken by the people in Starr's office, and more questions should have been asked before they very quickly became involved in this, what turned out to be quite messy case.
What are the ethical questions relating to reporting that remain the most blurry to you now?
Well, I think the ones, and I talk about this in the epilogue in the book, is the relationship between reporters and sources with an agenda. It is quite common, and indeed it is essential to investigative reporting, to have sources who insist upon an anonymity. and you are obligated as a journalist to respect that. But in this case, and I think it is a case that has applicability to many different avenues of reporting, one can learn a lot more over time about one's sources. And what do you do when you discover your sources are misleading you or doing things that make you feel uncomfortable? And what do you do when the sources themselves become the story? We have, you know, very clear professional and ethical lines about protecting our sources. And indeed, you know, we in all spheres of life, in all spheres of reporting, go to extraordinary lengths to do that. But once you make those deals with sources, you're stuck with them and put in very awkward situations, as I was in the course of this, when I discovered that, you know, my sources, in this case Tripp and to a lesser extent Lucianne Goldberg, were very much responsible for the events I was seeking to cover. It's not an easy question, and anybody who thinks there were easy answers here, I don't think has really thought through all the problems you can face.
Well, Michael Isikoff, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Michael Isikoff's new book is called Uncovering Clinton. Monica Lewinsky will be our guest on Fresh Air Friday, April 23rd. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. The American Library Association and Library Champions, celebrating the freedom to read, learn, and connect during National Library Week, April 11 through 17. And the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we discuss the alliance between Russia and the Serbs and the rift between East and West with the New York Times' Serge Schmaiman. He's the paper's acting foreign editor and former Moscow bureau chief. Schmaiman is also the author of a book about the Russian village his family is from. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war in Yugoslavia has widened the gulf between the U.S. and Russia, which has condemned the NATO bombing. Yesterday, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright met with her Russian counterpart, but little progress seemed to be made in closing the gap or creating a coordinated strategy to develop a peace plan. My guest, Serge Schmaiman, is an expert on Russia. He's the former Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times, where he's now acting foreign editor. Schmaiman is also the author of the book Echoes of a Native Land, a history of the Russian village which had been part of his family's estate before the family was driven out by the Russian Revolution. The book has just been published in paperback. I asked Serge Schmaiman about the historical reasons behind the alliance of Russia and Serbia.
Historically, there is a sense that these southern Slavs, Yugoslav, it means that, are kinfolk, are relatives, and they share the same Eastern Orthodox faith in World War I. And the Russians, of course, watched very carefully and before that. So there is a sort of an almost spiritual sense of a bond. Now, you can't take that too far. Perhaps it works when they both feel threatened from outside, but certainly the Russians had no love for Yugoslavia during the communist era, the Soviet Union, and you know, there is no great permanent alliance or linkage. You know, the languages are not all that close, although there are many common roots. But there is a sense that we are both Orthodox Slavic countries and we're both confronting a West that is to some degree callous and some degree patronizing towards us. Secondly, I think what we're beginning to see now is a certain bond, a certain linkage of old communists. Milosevic's wife is quite an adamant communist nationalist. The Russian parliament is very much dominated by communist nationalists, or nationalist communists, whichever way it works better, and that these people are beginning to see in this a certain chance to ride nationalist feelings back to some influence and power. You know, the strongest noises are being made by the old communists, whether in Russia, Belarus, or Yugoslavia. So there are two bonds, two sort of tenuous bonds which are being activated by this conflict.
Are there Russian agendas that are less than obvious that you could tell us about?
I don't think so. I think that in this case they are improvising, and in fact I think they have a certain problem. The Yugoslavs would like to draw them in as allies. The Yugoslav parliament has spoken of an alliance of Russia, Belarus, and Yugoslavia. And I think that's farther than the Russians would like to go. They still rely heavily on Western aid. They don't want to be totally excluded from global activities, from some some dealings with the United States. And so I'm not sure they want to go any further towards the Yugoslavs than they already have. But if this continues, I think both their public opinion and their own sense of indignation could drive them closer towards the Serbs. I'm not sure this is something, though, that they really desire or seek.
You know, I understand why people could be outraged at the bombing of Serbia, where civilians can get hurt. But it's hard to understand how people could side, how Russians could side with Milosevic if they have any idea of what's happening in Kosovo. Could you explain why there seems to be this growing support in Russia for Milosevic?
You know, I think in a curious way that you can separate the two, indignation over Kosovo and support for the Serbs, not so much for Milosevic. And it's not only the Russians. This is something we've seen in other parts of the world, including Greece, for example. And I think part of it is an irritation with NATO. It's been growing for quite some time. There is a sense that NATO is becoming a Western club, that NATO and the Americans in particular don't understand the Eastern world, that they have no idea what's going on there. That a large part of this policy of bombing, of reacting, is almost improvised, that there is a quality of a bully to it, you know, that NATO will impose its own solution on this problem. That's the one part. I think that, you know, much of it is just irritation with the West rather than specific support for the Serbs or for what they're doing. And secondly, I am not sure that anyone out there is getting a full picture. I know that Russian television did not show many of the scenes from Kosovo that we have been watching for quite a while. And now I gather they are beginning to, and perhaps getting a clear idea of what the Serbs are doing in Kosovo. And I'm sure once people see what's going on there, they do become indignant, they do become angry about it, but that does not translate into support for NATO. There is still a larger resentment of NATO and the role it has of a sort of a self-proclaimed peacemaker.
You know, you've written recently about the paradox of increased ethnic fighting during a time of globalization and jet travel and the internet uniting us, things that are making the world more interconnected. So how do you make sense of this paradox?
Well, I think we have found that the collapse of the communist world, of the old sort of bipolar world, black and white, us and them, has forced us to see again that, in fact, in many parts of the world, there are still lingering tribal, religious, ethnic identifications which are very strong. And even in an age of globalization, a dictator, a leader seeking autocratic power, finds this to be the easiest tool. So, you know, even a young Serb who's on the internet every day, speaks perfect English and has lived in Germany, can be inspired by a dictator, by Milosevic, to feel some Serbian feelings. I mean, even all these people who marched against Milosevic 2 years ago have joined in supporting the government on the war effort, because something stronger takes hold when you feel that your country is at war, that your country has to be supported when your country is being bombed. So we find that people have been quite successful, whether Saddam Hussein or Hafez Assad in Syria or Milosevic in Yugoslavia, in exploiting these feelings now that they have once again emerged from under the blanket of a bipolar world.
Serge Schmaderman, you're now the acting foreign editor at the New York Times, and I'm wondering if the Times reporters have been allowed back in Belgrade.
We have had one reporter, Steve Erlinger, doing a superb job all along. I mean, he was expelled for, I think, 2 days when everybody was chased out, and then his visa was valid and he was allowed back in. And he has been in Belgrade ever since, reporting on the people, how they're taking it. He's ventured out of town. For example, when the train was bombed, he was at the scene. We hope to get more people in. For now, Kosovo is closed to our reporters, and we're trying to get more people into the Serbian part as well. In Kosovo, of course, it's very important to get witnesses in on the ground to see exactly what has happened. We're dealing to such a degree on the statements of refugees and on the claims of NATO and the Pentagon. And we are really anxious to get witnesses of our own into that part of Yugoslavia to see what is going on.
How are you trying to get your reporters into Kosovo?
Basically, constantly waiting and looking for openings to see if the Yugoslavs will let them in, to see if they can drive down from Belgrade. You know, they are constantly asking and probing so far without meeting much success. In a situation like this, of course, the New York Times and any other news organization is very wary of having people injured. So there is a certain reluctance to sneak people in, of course. Because it is dangerous in there. There is bombing, there's roving bands of soldiers, there's all the obvious hazards. But it is terribly important to have somebody, as soon as possible, give an independent account of what has gone on and what is going on.
My guest is Serge Schmaderman, the New York Times acting foreign editor and former Moscow bureau chief. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Serge Schmiemann. He's the New York Times acting foreign editor and the Times' former Moscow, Bonn, and Jerusalem bureau chiefs. He's also the author of the book Echoes of a Native Land, Two Centuries of a Russian Village, which has just been published in paperback. You'd mentioned that Russians see NATO as this like Western club. Do you think that Russia and Yugoslavia and maybe Greece see this kind of connection through the Orthodox religion? Even though religion was taboo in Russia for so long, it's still such a part of the culture.
Certainly, that is a very major part of the bond they feel. As you say, of course, religion was suppressed in Russia for a long time. It is now emerging. It has not emerged fully yet as a dominant force in Russian life or in Russian culture. And Greece, of course, has had all the erosion of secularization, of modernization. So even if religion is no longer a dominant force in either society, it is one that forms a historical bond between them. They were all part of the Byzantine Orthodox world. And I think their sense is one that the Western Christianity, whether Catholicism or Protestantism, looks at them in a condescending way. You know, it's when the Pope demands an Easter pause in the bombing without taking into account that the Orthodox Easter is on a different date. This kind of thing leads to a perception that the West treats the East and their religion and their orthodoxy, which of course is every bit as ancient and as deep and as widespread, perhaps, as Western Catholicism, but they feel that it's treated in a condescending, patronizing way. So these things do create certain resentments, and certain resentments that bring the Russians and Greeks together in this sentiment.
Serge Schmiemann, in your book Echoes of a Native Land, in which you research the history of the village that your family is from, you write a little bit about your father, who was an Orthodox priest. And when he came to the United States, you say he became the guiding spirit in forming the Orthodox Church in America, and then also did radio broadcasts to Russia. Was it through Voice of America?
Through Radio Liberty.
Through Radio Liberty. Why was the Orthodox religion so important to him to keep alive in America at a time when it was being suppressed in Russia?
Well, part of it was that. Part of it, of course, is faith. He did believe in this, but his fundamental belief was that the Orthodox faith is universal. Many of the ethnic groups, the refugees coming to America, clung to religion because it was sort of a unifying force in their ethnic communities, whether it was Romanian, Bulgarian, Russian, Ukrainian, whatever. So they use the faith more as an ethnic bond. And my father's fundamental principle was that Orthodoxy is universal and equally applicable to the American situation, to the Western situation. And therefore, our church, the Orthodox Church in America, the church, and he was instrumental in forming is really an American church. The services are all in English, and the ethnic bond is in no way stressed or present.
What impact did it have on your ability to report in Russia when you were the Moscow bureau chief? And the authorities must have known that it was your father who was doing these Orthodox broadcasts through Radio Liberty.
I've often wondered, they never attacked him, and they never attacked my connection to him directly. They attacked every other member of the family, and they attacked me. I have a feeling that at some point, the KGB, which was, like everything else in the Soviet Union, a huge and clumsy bureaucracy, made the decision that they don't want to draw attention to this link. They knew that my father is quite well listened to, that he has quite a bit of authority. And if they declared, with whatever purpose, that I am in fact his son and made a big deal of this, this would only draw attention both to his radio broadcasts and to me, and an attention that they probably thought wouldn't be in their interest. That's the only way I could interpret it. because they consistently failed to draw the connection between us or to attack him in the press.
What about the Russian people? Did you run across a lot of people who heard your name and thought of your father and really respected and appreciated the work that he was doing?
Certainly, especially among the intellectuals, the intelligentsia. He was very widely known. He spoke not only on spiritual themes, but also about literature. So, you know, it was a very wide audience. His broadcasts were passed around on cassettes or in written form, and samizdat, as they called it, underground. So, and his books were as well. So he was a well-known figure, and it gave me a certain credibility, instant credibility in a certain part of the population. So I think that certainly was in my favor.
My guest is Serge Shmaimin. He's acting foreign editor at the New York Times. He also served as bureau chief in Moscow, Bonn, and Jerusalem. He's the author of a book called Echoes of a Native Land, Two Centuries of a Russian Village, which is part memoir, part history. It's a book in which he explores the history of the village that his family is from. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about that book. Your family was ordered out of the country by the Bolsheviks in, I think, 1918?
What happened was after the takeover of the land by the Bolsheviks, they were allowed to stay for a while, but then subsequent order came down when a more intensive crackdown began on the land to throw out all former landowners, and so they were driven out. But the villagers, the peasants, were tremendously loyal because they had a fairly good bond, and so they took them under armed guard to Moscow to make sure that they are not harmed along the way. They then stayed, most of them, outside Moscow. My grandfather and his brother left immediately after the war and made their way to France, but great-grandfather and sisters and others stayed and tried to make a go of it. But then one of their sons was arrested and executed by the Bolsheviks, and then they realized that they can't stay, and so at the very end of the 20s, they bought their way out, as many people were doing at that time. And so in 1928, they made their way to Paris.
Did studying your family history in Russia teach you a lot about purges and intolerance in ways that you feel you've constantly been applying to current stories?
Oh, it's hard to say, you know, what I mean. I've came to the United States. I was six and basically have grown up as an American. And I think, you know, most of my instincts and the perceptions are those of largely shaped by how I've grown up as an American. But I think, you know, just living abroad for many years, we lived abroad for 21 years, in all these various foreign assignments, it makes you quite sensitive, perhaps, to cultural differences. It makes you quite wary of imposing, you know, a certain model. And sometimes, you know, we do get the feeling that the United States, which does have this remarkable, functional, democratic, economic model, you know, which really is so extraordinarily effective and perhaps even just. So we begin to presume that it is universally applicable, and then we learn to our great dismay that it's not, that not every culture, and then in fact most cultures, are not prepared for a system of this sort, that they don't have the basic building blocks, whether in terms of democratic tradition, in terms of fair play, or in terms of economy, that they don't have the basic building blocks to handle our system. And so then we are dismayed. I think Russia is one example. You know, all of our perception of Russia today is based on the fact that their democracy hasn't really succeeded and that their economy is in shambles. But I think, you know, if we try to look at other things, culture, for example, which is very strong, we'd find that, you know, there are great books being published, superb poetry, that in fact there is freedom of expression, which is expressed for those who watch Russian television in superb documentaries. You know, so We don't look at the things they do well. We look at the things we expected them to do, which they've failed to do. Now, granted, you know, economic development and politics is terribly important. But what I'm saying is we always have to be careful, and this is something I have learned in the years abroad, we have to be careful not to constantly superimpose our own templates on every other part of the world.
My guest is Serge Shmaiman, the New York Times acting foreign editor. He's also the Times' former bureau chief in Moscow, Bonn, and Jerusalem. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Serge Shmaiman, New York Times acting foreign editor and former Moscow bureau chief, and author of the book Echoes of a Native Land, about the Russian village his family is from. Did finding your family's place in Russian history help connect you to the meaning of history?
It did very much. Not two ways. One is searching out their history, finding it in the archives, in their memoirs. It was an enormously gratifying kind of exercise because I learned so much, because there was so much to learn. I did not come up against frustrations. You know, doors would open. I kept finding more and more archives. But I think what made it really remarkable was that I had already spent about, you know, 9 years in the Soviet Union, in Russia, and that my basic root search coincided with the process of a country rediscovering its own past. You know, the Bolsheviks, the communists, had maintained a brutal grip on the past. This was their monopoly. They wrote histories. They told you what you could remember, what you couldn't remember. They controlled the images, who were heroes, who were the enemies. And so suddenly, an entire nation is freed to reassess its own past. And for me, the fascination of the process was the degree to which it coincided with what Russia was doing. You know, we would sit, when I would go to an archive, the people there, the archivists, would sit with me for hours just discussing what I was finding, and they became so involved that there were times when they would, you know, come to my house in Moscow and say, look what else I found. And, you know, it was a joint process of going backwards, which lasted for a few years. Of course, then Russia's own problems took over. The past became less fascinating, you know, because the present became stage center. And to some degree, we parted ways. To some degree, the project ran its course and ended. And, I mean, when I end the book, people say it's a bit perhaps sad, perhaps pessimistic, because basically I leave a Russia that I feel slipping away again, slipping into a form that is not necessarily welcoming to me and in which I really no longer have a part. And so when I leave, it is with the knowledge that I really don't belong there. I found my place there. I claimed my place there in that history. But it's not my place any longer.
In what sense do you feel the country slipping away?
It went back to the instincts of, well, how should I phrase this? I mean, it's what I was saying. You know, their unfamiliarity with democracy. They were you know, the way that Yeltsin had to bomb his own White House, the way the church was becoming very nationalist in its orientation, you know, they were still very much their own nation, and the scars of communism, you knew, would take generations to heal. They were still very much shaped by these 70 years of communism, by the history they'd had before, by the fact that they really have never had what we know as a rule of law, where the law is above all. All these things are not yet familiar. They were again becoming suspicious of me. Why was I there? You know, here I was, an American who wasn't sort of spending money, investing, wasn't doing all the things I'm expected to
That's
do.
That's right.
Just raising a lot of questions. And so they found that they have no need of me any longer. And I ran out of things to ask. And we parted ways. I still am in contact. I get letters. I have terrific friends. But the book, in a way, I guess as Roots books tend to do, it satisfied that part of me that needed to lay a claim to this part of my heritage.
Well, Serge Maimon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Serge Maimon is the New York Times acting foreign editor and former Moscow bureau chief. His book, Echoes of a Native Land, about the Russian village his family is from, has just been published in paperback. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374. Fresh Air is also available online at audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Tor Books, publisher of Terry Goodkind's Soul of the Fire, available wherever books are sold, and Garden.com, an online source for gardening advice and home delivery of over 14,000 plants, tools, and gardening products. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we call Belgrade and talk to a writer and historian about life during the NATO bombing. And we talk to the people who have established a new system for reuniting family members separated during the exile from Kosovo. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.